Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 90 of Dogcast Radio. In this episode, we hear about the Swedish Kennel Club.
I think we're right to be held up and celebrated as a country that is working actively to support dogs, dog health, dog care.
Buddy's been somewhere exciting, and we have the Dogcast Radio news. But first, I talked to Nancy Kay, who is a vet and the author of Speaking for Spot, Be the Advocate Your Dog Needs to Live a Happy, Healthy, Longer Life. That sounds like the kind of owner every dog needs and wants, and you can hear right now, straight from Nancy, how to become that.
The book is all about teaching people how to really, in essence, be savvy consumers of veterinary medicine. It teaches people how to be really great medical advocates for their pets. And even though the book is Speaking for Spot, and it's about dogs, and hopefully someday there will be a Talking for Tabby, the principles in the book really apply across the board, truthfully, beyond canine health to feline health matters and even human health matters. They're all the same advocacy principles. And the goal of this is to teach people how to be stellar medical advocates, which means that they are making decisions for their pets coming from an extremely informed position. And the end result of making informed decisions is that ideally you end up with the very best decision for the dog or cat, as well as the best decision for your own peace of mind. And so the book really teaches people how to be that medical advocate, how to figure out when the decision-making is really tough and no one really knows what the outcome will be if you choose path A or path B. How do you go about making that decision in a way that's best for your dog and that where you'll end up having the best peace of mind? You won't be in a state of guilt or regret.
Yeah, yeah. Now, your first chapter deals, it's entitled Medical Advocacy, and it sort of deals more specifically with why your dog needs you to be his advocate, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, things aren't so simple anymore. I mean, there's a lot more choices out there than ever before. When I graduated from veterinary school, for example, there were 5 vaccinations available for dogs. Now there are 13.
Wow.
When I graduated from veterinary school, if you wanted to do any sort of imaging on the body, you took an X-ray. Now you have the choice of an X-ray, an ultrasound evaluation, a CAT scan, or an MRI scan. There's all sorts of specialists that you have access to, dermatologists, ophthalmologists, cardiologists, internal medicine doctors, the list goes on and on. And then there's the choice of, do you want to go with Western medicine versus Eastern medicine or holistic medicine, which is a combination of the two. So number one, there's a great deal many more choices. And the other very significant factor is that really and truly in exchange for all of that unconditional love and all the tail wagging that we get from our dogs day in and day out, we really owe it to them to be the one who makes the decisions on their behalf rather than someone who doesn't know them all that well. In other words, the person living with the dog really should be the team captain. The veterinarian is an important member of the healthcare team, but it's that person who shares their bed with the dog and goes on camping trips and hikes and knows that dog's behavior in and out. They're the ones that really should be in control of making the decisions. And that's an awful lot of power to have. Mm-hmm. And it's in your dog's best interest for you to be the one to have that power, but you want to come at it from an informed position.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a lovely viewpoint for a vet to have, because so often I haven't personally felt this, but I've heard people sort of where they're in a position where the vet is sort of the expert and telling them, you must do this, you mustn't do this, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, without consultation, you know.
Right. I tell people to really shy away from veterinarians that say you have to, you need to, you must. For example, I just came out of an exam room before this interview with someone with a kitty who we diagnosed has cancer, and we talked about cancer therapy for her kitty.
Mm.
And she said, what would you do? And that's a question I am very commonly asked. What would I do if he or she were my own pet?
Yeah.
And I answer honestly. And sometimes the honest answer is, I'm not really sure what I would do right at the moment. I'd have to put a lot more thought into it. In this case, I could tell this woman, based on what I know to be true about your cat, if she were mine, I would choose to treat. That being said, that doesn't mean that that's what's right for you and your kitty.
Mm.
So I'm very willing to share what I would do, but I would never say you should, you need to. I lead a client support group here for people who are really struggling with the grief process around their animals' illnesses or the loss of an illness. And people often who really get stuck in the grief process are people who listen to their veterinarian when they said, you should do this. You should put your cat to sleep now. You should put your dog to sleep now. You should take him to surgery. And then what they feel like is they let their best friend down when they find out it really was the wrong decision, or, gosh, you know, they really think that they acted hastily. They put their pet to sleep much sooner than really they needed to. So collect all the information you need from your veterinarian, from other sources, but the decision should really be yours. That's sort of holding up your end of the bargain in this relationship of unconditional love that your animal gives you day in and day out.
Yeah, it's the least you can do.
Yes.
As you say, yeah. Now, you have another chapter called The Office Visit, What You Can Do to Help Your Dog and Your Vet. So what's in that?
Well, probably one of the most fun things in that chapter is what I call the 10 commandments of veterinary office visits.
Mm.
And these are what I call 10 tried and true secrets to making every visit to your dog's veterinarian exceptional for you, your dog, and the entire staff. And they're simple things, really, in theory. For example, thou shalt let the staff know if thy dog is aggressive.
Mm.
I recall one particularly nasty bite to my hand. And a bite, and I hope I'm not jinxing myself, but bites are exceedingly rare because we're so darn good at reading dogs and cats when we come in the exam room. But I remember a shepherd that, with no warning, no eye contact, nothing, just nailed me.
Mm.
And, you know, that's so terrifying and frustrating when that happens.
Yeah.
And I was out at the sink washing my hand, and I heard the client say to me, oh, yeah, that happened with the last vet that we... So there's one of the commandments is that simple. The commandment that I've heard the most feedback about, really positive feedback about, is the first commandment, which is thou shalt push thy veterinarian off her pedestal. And, you know, Julie, that pedestal is usually a figment of the client's imagination.
Yeah.
Most veterinarians don't put themselves on pedestals. In fact, I purposefully don't wear a white coat in the exam room because I think that creates a significant degree of separation between I am the doctor and you are the client kind of thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for me. Plus, I'm always too warm. I don't like wearing a jacket. But the point is that if you treat your veterinarian with awe and put them on a pedestal, that's really going to hinder open, honest communication. So if your veterinarian is making suggestions that don't feel quite right to you, you might have a harder time questioning that. If your veterinarian says, let's use an antibiotic that I'll have you give 3 times a day, but you know that your work schedule would make that crazy for you, you can really only give medication 2 times a day, you want to have a comfort level to say, you know, that's not really feasible for me.
Mm.
Or I can only work within a certain budget. If your veterinarian's up on a pedestal because of your own notion of him or her, then that it's going to really be an obstacle to open, honest communication. And I really think that open, honest communication makes a huge difference in terms of what happens ultimately for your dog or cat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you say, some of that is set by the vet and how ready they are to listen to you. But a lot of that does come from the owner. And I guess some of that comes from the fact that sometimes when we go to the vet, we're in terrible trouble with our pet and we desperately want someone that can make it right and sort of wave a magic wand. And that's why you elevate them to that status, isn't it?
Perhaps. I think that that's probably one of the ingredients in that. I think we do that, too, with medical doctors. I am guilty of sometimes doing that with my children's teachers, politicians, perhaps, celebrities, sports stars. You just and I'm not quite sure all the reasons behind it, but I do know that that's common. It's very common.
Yeah, yeah. But as you say, you need to see them more as, you know, a partner to work towards the best for your animal, don't you?
Exactly. And so that's a matter of finding a veterinarian that you feel very comfortable communicating with openly and honestly so that it's a more informal, casual, easy conversation rather than a formal one where you feel a little bit intimidated.
Yeah, yeah. Now, thou shalt confess everything.
Yeah.
In there. What does that mean?
Well, I'll give you the classic example that we sometimes see here in our practice in Northern California. You'll have to tell me if that happens in your neck of the woods.
Okay.
Occasionally we'll have an animal come in with the most bizarre symptoms, and we have a test we can do, a urine test, to find out if the dog has ingested marijuana.
Oh, right.
But it makes it a lot easier. We get to the bottom of the problem. We can treat a lot more expediently if the person says, you know what, I made a batch of marijuana brownies and my dog got into them.
Yes, yeah.
And so, and we don't report anyone, but it, even if you, the example I can give you is that I trimmed the rhododendrons in the yard and I fed the rhododendron trimmings to the goats. Yes, I should know. I went through veterinary school. Rhododendrons, azaleas, camellias, they're toxic for goats, but I'd forgotten that. And so I had to sheepishly call the goat veterinarian, because I don't treat goats, and confess what I had done. And I was so embarrassed. But by confessing what I had done, he immediately knew what the problem was and how best to treat them.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, obviously you're going to be embarrassed perhaps, but as you say, for the good of the dog, tell
right.
the
truth. If you've been sharing your prescription medications with your dog, if you fed your dog something that you knew he wasn't supposed to have, if your dog ingested an illegal drug, if your dog wasn't tethered in the back of the pickup truck and jumped out while you were speeding down the highway, come clean. You know, confess to your veterinarian. Make it a confessional. Your dog will be better for it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the chapters that I found intriguing is, wow, I didn't know you could do that on dogs.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And there's some amazing things in there. What's nuclear medicine?
Nuclear medicine involves the use of what things we call nucleotides, radioactive nucleotides, and then we use a certain type of camera called a gamma camera. So a radioactive material is injected into the dog, and then using this very cool gamma camera, we can track it in the dog's body. One of the ways it's used is to look at thyroid glands, the same studies that are done in women with thyroid disease. We sometimes can use it to determine if there's an abnormal shunting of blood around the liver rather than through the liver. So it comes in very handy for very specific types of diseases.
Yeah, yeah, wow. And now, blood transfusions, particularly in dogs, can be quite difficult, can't it?
You know, they're not all that difficult here where I practice because we have blood readily available in our hospital that we obtain from a canine blood bank. And there are different blood types in dogs, so we do have to do a test to make sure that the donor and the recipient are compatible before we administer the transfusion. And we administer different types of transfusions. Let's say that the dog is anemic, meaning the red blood cell count is lower than it should be, then we may transfuse with just red blood cells. If the dog is having a bleeding problem because of, let's say, he ingested rat poison or mouse bait, that prevents normal blood from clotting. And so in that situation, rather than giving whole blood, we'll give just what we call the plasma, which is rich with coagulation factors that are missing or dysfunctional, rendered dysfunctional because of the rat poison. So there's even different types of blood products that we can use. And we get that all from the blood bank, which is, it's really nice to have it readily on hand. And so at least in this practice, blood transfusions are fairly simple and straightforward. If we didn't have that, then probably everyone who works here, their dogs would come in on an as-needed basis to donate blood.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I mean, reading a lot of the headings in that chapter of the treatments that are available for dogs, it's getting towards the point where, you know, it is a lot of the things that are available for humans, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the most exciting things that really an area that's advancing tremendously is stem cell therapy. And in that sense, we're kind of almost ahead of what's happening in the human world of human medicine, probably because we haven't been held back by any of the philosophical or religious debates that have been going on around stem cell therapy for people. And so right now, at least in dogs, stem cell therapy, we also call it regenerative cell therapy.
Hmm.
It's being used to help with the repair and healing of injured tendons and ligaments in the treatment of severe arthritis. And what happens is we'll collect a sample of the dog's fat tissue, and that serves as the source of the stem cells. And we send it off to a special laboratory where they take these fat cells and they go through the intricate process of growing and harvesting stem cells. Then they're returned to the veterinarian who injects them into the area that's diseased.
Oh.
And we've seen some really wonderful results.
Yeah. Oh, that's... I mean, it really is...
It's exciting.
Yes. I mean, as you say, I really didn't know you could do that on dogs. It's amazing.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, moving on to what is obviously always a really difficult area. One of your chapters is euthanasia, making the best of a difficult situation. So if you're facing that situation with your dog, you know, what do you need to bear in mind?
Well, there's a lot to think about. And, you know, Julie, the unfortunate fact of the matter is that about 98% of the time when we have a dog or a cat, we're going to have to go through this. It's exceedingly rare that an animal simply passes away peacefully in their sleep. And when a client calls and tells me that that's what's happened, I really let them know. I tell them how sorry I am, but I also let them know how lucky they were that they were spared having to go through this really traumatic, difficult process.
Yeah.
Of making end-of-life decisions. And it's never easy. It's not meant to be easy. If it seems easy, then you may not be thinking about everything that you perhaps should be thinking about. Probably the most common question that I get is, how will I know when it's the right time? And the reason people ask that is they want to be sure that they're not opting for euthanasia too soon. And what I am constantly reminding people about is that's really wonderful. No one wants to make this decision too soon, but sometimes in worrying about that, people end up finding that they've made the decision too late. And so you really want to watch it from both perspectives. You want to be sure to try to not act too hastily, but likewise, many people really suffer when they recognize that, gosh, they probably let their pet linger and suffer longer than was really in their pet's best interest.
Yeah.
You know, there is no formula for figuring out the very best or the correct time. What I tell people is the challenge is in figuring out when the time is just right for you and your dog or you and your cat. So there's certain criteria to look at. I tell people, I encourage people, if we're talking about dogs here, does he still respond enthusiastically to the things that would normally excite him? For example, getting out his favorite tennis ball. If normally when you say, hey, you want to go for a ride, does he get real excited about that? When he hears the UPS truck in the driveway, does he still get excited about that? Is he still eating? And for many dogs, appetite is a pretty good indicator of quality of life. For certain breeds... Golden Retrievers, Labradors, perhaps dogs that really eat anything in sight, anytime, anywhere. You have to take that with a grain of salt because some of those breeds, I think, might quit breathing before they quit eating. Do the good days still seem to outnumber the bad days? In the past week, have there been 2 so-so days and 5 pretty lousy days? And then probably most importantly, when you really go eyeball to eyeball with your dog, do you still see that sort of familiar spark in his eye that lets you know that he wants to keep on going? And if you do see that little spark, try to be sure that it's not a spark put on as, in other words, is he doing a pretty good job acting, saying, oh yeah, I want to keep going, because he thinks it's his job to keep going for you. So really spend some eyeball to eyeball time with your dog. On the inside cover of my book is a photo of me with Lexi, who was 17 years old at the time that photo was taken. And I actually I give these sort of vignettes in the book because my husband is also a veterinarian. And it took us almost a year of soul searching and having lots of discussions with Lexi and kind of looking back on weeks to figure out if the good days still outnumbered the bad days. And it was about a year before we said, yeah, it's really time. So even with two veterinarians living in the household, it can be a very difficult decision.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many, you know, and sometimes conflicting emotions involved, because every instinct in you is to protect your dog.
Yeah.
And it feels like a betrayal, doesn't it? Although you're acting in their interests, that's how it can feel.
Oh, you know, I think that euthanasia in the right circumstances is probably the most loving, generous decision a person can make.
Yeah.
And at the very beginning of that chapter, Julie, is something that it's very hard for me to get through, honestly, without getting teary, but I truly believe. May I read this?
Yes, of course.
It's from A Pet's Prayer by Beth Norman Harris, and I really believe in these words. It says, "And beloved Master, when I am very old and the great Master sees fit to deprive me of my health, do not turn me away from you. Rather, take my trusting life gently, and I shall leave you, knowing with the last breath I draw, my fate was always safest in your hands."
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it?
Well, it captures it. You know, I think many of us who chose veterinary medicine, part of the reason we chose it is that we were given the legal ability to end suffering. And we sure love animals.
Yes.
That's for sure. But some people might have been tempted to go into human medicine. But the thought of being able to end suffering humanely may have entered into their decisions.
As you say, it's something that you have to handle very carefully. And again, you're in partnership with your vet, aren't you, at that point?
Yes. And you had asked me, too, you know, what do people need to be thinking about during this time? What many people, I believe, don't quite realize is that when it comes to the euthanasia process or the end-of-life process, there are many choices there as well. Where will the pet be euthanized? It certainly doesn't have to be in a veterinary hospital setting.
Yeah.
It can be at home. A few weeks ago, I euthanized a dog out in the family car, because the dog loved being in the car.
Aww.
And so that's where the euthanasia took place, with Oh Danny Boy playing on a CD in the radio.
Yeah.
Who would be present?
Yeah.
Members of the family certainly can be present. Will there be a little service associated with it? How will the remains be cared for? Would you want a lock of hair? Would you want a little clay paw print?
Those are
all options. And another option is hospice care for people who really, for philosophical, religious reasons, they euthanasia isn't a reasonable option. Or they're not ready for euthanasia, and yet they don't want to go further with treatments. Then hospice care might be an option until it's very clear that euthanasia is the right thing to do.
Yeah. Gosh, I've never heard of dog or animal hospices.
Well, they're perhaps not as well organized as in the human profession, although I have a feeling within a decade or so they will be. But what hospice really means is We know we're not aggressively treating the disease. Mm. We're letting the disease take its course, but we're going to keep the patient as physically and emotionally comfortable as possible, and the human members of the family as emotionally comfortable with it as possible.
Yeah.
And so that means care in the home, not in the hospital, with adequate levels of pain medication and nursing care, and not doing anything to the patient that the patient doesn't like.
Yeah, yeah. That must be a wonderful support for some people.
Yes. Yes, and it used to be a big conundrum for me because I had a patient before me that was miserable, horrible, suffering, and the person's, let's say, religion dictated that, you know, that they said, I refuse to play God. I will not end my dog's life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a veterinarian, that was a terrible dilemma for me because my first allegiance was then and remains, my first allegiance is always to the dog or the cat.
Mm-hmm.
And how could I reconcile this? That I needed to end the dog's suffering or the cat's suffering, but the person involved wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
And so hospice provides a way out of that, which is I can provide comfort. I can provide pain medication. I can provide nursing care, teach them how to do that until death occurs naturally.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it strikes me that the book, it's a wonderful book, and it's going to help a lot of people make better decisions for their dog. It's great.
Thank you.
That's no problem. Is it Sandy, the name of the dog that's on the cover?
Yes.
Yeah, and can you tell us a little bit about Sandy?
Yes. She's a very fun girl. We first learned about her through the Marin Humane Society. She was a dog that showed up at the Marin Humane Society, and they needed to find a home for her. And they weren't sure that she would be very placeable because not only did she have heartworm disease, and after you treat heartworm disease, a month of very strict confinement is required.
Oh.
But also, she was wild. She had no manners whatsoever. And so Sandy became a member of the first class of what's called the Pen Pals program. And the Pen Pals program is a Marin Humane Society program where they send dogs that need to recuperate from diseases or need socialization and training to San Quentin State Penitentiary, which is only, gosh, about 10 miles away.
Hmm.
And deserving inmates are paired with dogs. And Sandy was in that program, and she lived with an inmate named Ron. And Sandy recovered from her heartworm disease, and she became much better behaved. In fact, Ron taught her a litany of commands. One of her commands was stay, and the release from the stay command was the word parole.
I like it.
It so happens that Sandy and Ron were paroled from San Quentin at the same time.
Hmm.
And Sandy actually continued to live with Ron for about a year, until he had an unfortunate death in his family, and he had to go back east to handle the family business, and he was unable to take Sandy with him. Mm. So Sandy went back to Marin Humane Society, where she was adopted by an extremely loving family in Marin County, California. That's the county just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, so just north of San Francisco. And Sandy's come to a number of my local book signings. The only complaint I have is she's about 10 pounds overweight. But I have a feeling that's not going to change.
No. You have to pick your battles sometimes.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, that's a lovely story. Where can people find out more about you on the internet?
The web address is www.speakingforspot.com. And not only can they learn more about me and learn more about Speaking for a Spot, there's some things there that everybody can utilize, whether they have a dog or a cat. If you click on advocacy aids, there's a number of healthcare templates that you can download for keeping track of your own animal's health. For example, if your dog or cat is taking a good number of medications, you can have a copy of the same sort of treatment sheet that we use in the hospital to help you keep track of the treatments and the timing of them. There's something called a contingency form so that if you're going to be out of town out of the country and perhaps not reachable, it's a form where you are really giving a directive for someone else to be the decision maker in your absence. So let's say an animal arrives here that has just been hit by a car and is going to surgery, and the owners are in Africa and cannot be reached.
Mm.
That form in the record would allow me to know that, yes, I can give this person who's not the official owner permission to make decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, the veterinarian's a little stuck not being sure what to do.
Yeah.
So there's a number of forms like that. Also, if people click on resources, it'll provide a number of organizations that provide financial assistance for taking care of pets' health if the owner is not able to come up with the financial means to do so themselves.
Oh, excellent. Oh, that's really useful, isn't it? That's brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. And you also have a blog, is that right?
Yes, and the blog can be accessed via the website.
Right. Okay. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure, and let's do it again in the future.
She must be wonderful to have as your vet. I found Nancy fascinating to talk to, and I'd love to pick her brains on your behalf another time. We have links on the Dogcast Radio site to her website and blog, both of which are well worth visiting. So go ahead and be a great advocate for your dog.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
A dog is one of the remaining reasons why some people can be persuaded to go for a walk. O.A. Batista.
Buddy's Diary.
Hello, Buddy the Black Labrador here. I've been to a really exciting place. It was called Crufts and was a great big party for dogs. There were so many dogs and people there that as soon as I walked in, I started drooling. I couldn't help myself. There was the waft of so many scents for the dogs, as well as so many dog-friendly smelling people. And on top of that, there were the aromas of scrummy food, so you can see why I got so excited. Walking around the show, I became aware that there were lots of dog foods and treats on display. And on offer too. I don't need to be offered food twice. I got stuck in tasting all the samples I could. It was fantastic. It was very busy, so I got to see lots of legs from the knee down. And lots of feet, which I had to make sure didn't end up landing on me. Some dogs were being wheeled around in trolleys. That looked safe, but they didn't have the access to all the goodies that I did, so I preferred to take my chances on my own 4 feet. I also got to greet loads of other dogs who were walking around. I've been to some big gatherings of dogs, but never anything like this. Most of them seemed to be playing a game where they have to stand very still while someone called a judge plays with each one of them in turn. First the judge looks at each dog really hard, then he does his best to distract them. He puts his hands on their head, and then, you won't believe this, he prizes their mouth open and has a good look inside. That's taking things too far if you ask me. I mean, a dog's mouth is his own business. Anyway, the judge runs his hands all over the dog, trying to tickle him everywhere. And sometimes he even pulls the dog's tail right out behind him. He might even start inspecting parts of the canine anatomy that are best left only investigated by another dog's nose. And that's another area that is a dog's own business. I have had a go at this game of standing still while the judge plays with you, and I was no good at it at all. As soon as the judge touched me, I started wagging my tail and wiggling, and then I jumped up and tried to lick them. I forgot all about standing still and where my feet should be, but to be honest, I think my version of the game is way better. There were lots of other things for dogs to do, like jumping over things and dancing with their person and showing off all the clever stuff they could do. But I'll let you into a secret. I was there for the most fun thing of all, because I was there to meet people. You see, I am a nice dog, and that's official. I went to see someone from the Blue Cross charity who looked at me and played a few games with me and realised that I am a really friendly fellow who is safe to meet grown-ups and children and help spread the message about the Blue Cross to them. The Blue Cross teaches people about the right way to treat animals and help sick animals get better, and I was proud to represent them. They had a stand at Crufts, and I was there with my person, and I got to meet loads of people. I did my very best to look friendly, and as soon as anyone touched me, I collapsed onto my back and let them rub my tummy as long as they wanted to. If there was more than one person who wanted to speak to me at the same time, I had a different approach. In that situation, I would wiggle round in a small circle so that everyone got a fair share of me. Being with the Dogcast radio team, I got to go into the press room, although I don't know why it's called the press room, as it wasn't very crowded in there, and there was no one ironing their laundry. Whatever it was called, it was an excellent room as everyone in there loved dogs, and I got so much attention and fuss, and so many sneaked bits of food. I loved it. I didn't win any rosettes or awards of any kind, but I had a wonderful time, and apparently the humans have a saying at Crufts that win or lose, you always take the best dog home. I might be hopeless at the standing still while the judge tickles you game, but I know my person thinks he took the best dog home, and that's what matters most to me. I wonder if the Blue Cross will let me go to Crufts next year. I hope so, and if they do, I'll tell you all about it. Till next time.
A cat, after being scolded, goes about its business. A dog slinks off into a corner and pretends to be doing a serious self-reappraisal. Robert Brault. In the last episode of Dogcast Radio, we heard from Basset breeder John Buskell about how to be the ideal puppy buyer. John breeds his dogs in Sweden, so I was eager to find out about the Swedish Kennel Club from him. In the UK, it's often held up as a good role model for our kennel club. So what exactly is it doing that's so good?
I think part of Swedish mentality is that everything is a committee. Every level of society is a committee and there are meetings. Look at the Swedish football team. Individually, the Swedish footballers aren't, well, sorry listeners, but you know, they're not particularly great. Collectively, they do pretty well, actually. Whereas, say, for example, England, a nation of individuals, get together and fight and fall apart when they're a team. And I think the Kennel Club is really good because as a central organization for dogs and dog breeders and people involved in dogs, it talks to its community. Got a Basset yawning here.
Oh.
It talks to its community. It listens and it leads, but not in a dogmatic way.
Hmm.
I think the Swedish Kennel Club is quite cautious. For example, there's just recently I translated a bunch of guidelines that have gone out to foreign judges, and that took years to be put, a couple of years to be put together. Conferences, there's been a series of conferences where they've looked at the statistical information from vets, had discussion with vets, looked at the breeds that are having problems, suggested changes to breed clubs. And, you know, I think from the top down, as committees, this works very, very well. There's a lot of information and it filters through.
Yeah.
I also think, though, and it's funny because, of course, I have connections to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I follow the British media and what's going on in the dog world in England very closely.
Mm.
And it amuses me greatly when Sweden is held up as this pinnacle of greatness in terms of kennel clubs. Both Beverly Cuddy, the editor of, I think it's Dogs Today, Jemima Harrison, the director of Pedigree Dogs Exposed, both of them have said to me, oh, please don't ruin our view of the Swedish Kennel Club, because, I mean, they have both talked of the mandatory testing that the Swedish Kennel Club talks about.
Yes.
That is not the case. Hmm. Not all breeds here have mandatory testing.
Hmm. Do you feel that, I mean, is it the case that those that need it have mandatory or...
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, yes, there is. I think if you look at breeds like Border Collies, Collies, Labradors, Basset Hounds. These are dogs that are actually very, very healthy and doing very, very well here.
Mm.
And I think a lot of that has come because of Kennel Club intervention. I know the Basset that has been criticised quite recently, but I do think that if you actually look at the statistics, and compare us to other countries. What's going on here in Sweden from kennel club directives has done a lot to ensure health.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think perhaps that the Swedish breeders are more open to, you know, these directives or advice from the kennel club? Because, you know, looking on various websites here, some people, when they've done, you know, they've been associated with a breed for years, you know, they know it all. Yeah. And I've read things about, you know, sort of, I can look at a dog and tell whether it's healthy or not. And there's very much that attitude. And you think, well, no, actually, you know, you're going to need the health test. So do you think the Swedish breeders are more open to that?
Are they more open?
To the advice from the kennel club.
Yeah, I think they listen. We have a couple of magazines that come round every other month that are one if you're a breeder that you subscribe to, which they're actually talking about giving away free to. If you're a member of the Kennel Club in Sweden, you get a magazine every other month, a very thick magazine.
Mm.
And they're actually talking about giving the more in-depth breeder-orientated magazine free to breeders.
Wow.
And I think what this does is there is, like we talked about before, there is a culture of education, a culture of sharing knowledge, and I think people listen. But Sweden's also a country where, you know, the government is involved from the cradle to the grave. There is a reason that a lot of people work for the state, that a lot of things are state-owned. And I think that also affects dog breeders. You know, we're used to being responsible. For example, if you buy a dog from me in Sweden,
hmm.
I am under our, what's Konsumentlagen, under our, the law that protects consumers.
Yes, yeah.
I am legally responsible for any problems with that dog for 3 years.
Wow.
And you can come back to me during that time and get the amount of money that you can get back goes down over the 3 years.
Mm.
But the Swedish, you know, consumer legislation means that I'd have to make sure that my dogs are pretty healthy, because otherwise people can come back to me during 3 years and say, I want a major portion of my money back.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that makes sure that people are very, very careful.
Mm, mm. I was going to say, because one of the things here in the UK is the Kennel Club has said, you know, we have no legal powers, and if we try to enforce things, people will stop coming to us. Now, that's arguable. So does the Swedish Kennel Club itself have any legal powers or not? That's just sort of consumer protection law.
That's consumer protection law. The Kennel Club only has powers, like I assume most kennel clubs do, to ban people who break
yes,
the code
yeah.
of practice.
Yeah.
That's all that they have.
Yeah. And how well policed, you know, in a sense, does the Swedish Kennel Club, how well do they check up on breeders?
That's an interesting question. I'm just trying to think.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I mean, for myself, you know, I registered a kennel.
Mm.
No one ever asked me what my qualifications were or if I'd done a course. I had done one,
mm.
but I registered a kennel. There are guidelines and regarding the number of dogs that you can have on a particular premises. I don't know if the Kennel Club have come and spied on me and looked at my premises.
Yeah.
They've certainly never booked a meeting and come and looked around.
No.
But you know, in terms of things like having dog daycare and all that kind of legislation, that's where there are, you know, people linked to the Kennel Club, the people that inspect kennels and dog daycares, that's where they probably go and do their...
Yes.
You know, they have to legally go and do their looking. But
yeah.
No, so I would say as an individual, just purely of myself as a breeder, I have never been, you know, I've never been investigated, looked at, talked to or questioned. But I don't have anything to hide, so I would welcome it anyway. But, you know, so it's not, it doesn't feel super intrusive.
No, no. The other thing that you said as a member of the Swedish Kennel Club.
Yeah.
Now, I got told off on a website, on a forum, because I called breeders members of the UK Kennel Club, and
yeah.
they're not. It's invitation only. It is a club. And so the breeders are accredited breeders, but they are not technically members of the Kennel Club.
Uh-huh.
So now, is that the case in Sweden or not?
No, when you buy a dog and you have to have your dog registered, and when you register, you have the option to join a breed club, and the Kennel Club, and when you become a member, you are a member of that club.
Yeah.
So you are. I think this goes back again to sort of the whole sort of Swedish thing of of committees.
Yes.
That once you're in, you have the opportunity to influence things and to get involved through breed clubs or through the larger umbrella organisation. So we are members. You receive letters. You receive a very, very good cogent magazine that is geared to educating everyone involved in the community, owners and breeders.
Now, to talk sort of about Basset Hounds, they were criticised in Pedigree Dogs Exposed, in that, you know, in the UK, with this thing called furnishings, which is the folds of skin, isn't it? So, you know, do Basset Hounds in Sweden have that problem or not?
I can't speak for every Basset Hound in this country.
No, no.
Well, what I can say is, and I think you have to look at Norway and Sweden, because we share a border with Norway, and so, you know, we move our dogs between both countries.
Yeah.
You know, Norway and Sweden is very open. I think if you look at the Basset Hound in Norway and Sweden, statistically, we have been put on, in Sweden, we have been put on the list of 10 breeds that are at risk for extremities. In other words, eye problems, excessive folds of skin that lead to skin problems. So I mean, we're on a list of 10 dogs. But when I look at the community of Basset Hounds and people that own Bassets, what I hear is a lot of frustration that our healthy dogs are actually not being held up and celebrated, and some breeds that are known here to have lots of problems aren't on this magic list of 10. And you know, Pedigree Dogs Exposed took images of Bassets from the 19th century and compared them to Bassets in the 20th, 21st century. That was very spurious, because there were also images from when Bassets were first bred, that are very, very similar to how dogs are today. And I think the other thing is, excessive skin does not necessarily, mean skin problems. I've seen dogs, Bassets, that have very little loose skin that have skin problems. I've seen Bassets with massive wrinkling and being completely overdone and not have any skin problems at all. So I think what I'd like to see is, I'd like to see the statistics from the Veterinary Association. I'd like to see that made open. And then I'd like to have a proper discussion about health issues.
Yeah.
I think what's happened here is that the media has jumped on particular breeds like the Shar Pei, the Basset, and said, these dogs look overly extreme. They can't even move. They've got so much skin. And I say, come and have a look at my dogs. Look at them run around in the field.
Yes.
You know, I just put something up on YouTube the other day, of Basset pups tearing around in the garden. And these are so-called dogs that, can't walk. So I think the emphasis is, let's see what we need to do to make the breed healthier. Where are the problems? Let's identify the real problems. And I think, I'm very, open to there being problems, but what are they? Let's see statistically what they are and what we can do about them. I'm very, very concerned that in Sweden we have a small population of Bassets. I'm very concerned that we have Matador Arvel, that one or two stud dogs are repeatedly used, and that we have a small genetic a small pool of genes. That to me is a much bigger issue. Line breeding,
Yes.
The results of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, obviously the answer seems to be no, but is the use of particular stud dogs, you know, well, stud dogs, restricted or not?
Some breed clubs have a limit. The French bulldog, I think, they limit the number of times a dog can be used. Mm. And if you use the dog too many times at stud, then you will be, you know, ceremoniously booted out of the club.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's great.
I would
love that in all clubs. I would love to have that as mandatory. The trouble is that some population sizes are different. You know, a breed like, oh, I don't know, a breed that has 10,000 dogs
in
a country is very different to a breed that has 100.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. It's a fascinating subject, though. Is there anything else that you would like to say sort of about the Swedish Kennel Club or the situation in Sweden?
I think we're right to be held up and celebrated as a country that is working actively to support dogs, dog health, dog care. We don't have a big problem with dogs, stray dogs, or dogs being in rescue. That's unheard of here, really. There are one or two rescues, but basically, Swedes bring dogs from Spain and Ireland to Sweden. You know, we rescue dogs from abroad because there aren't that many rescue dogs here.
Mm.
And that's, I think, a big testament to, well, how dogs are, you know, how dog owners are in Sweden and the Kennel Club. You know, I do think the Kennel Club is doing a lot to promote care for dogs. So
yeah.
I think that's really, really strong. I do think we're right to be celebrated for or held up as a model for openness. I do think there is a lot of openness. You know, people, you know, if you go into the Kennel Club website, it doesn't work with very many browsers, but I think the Internet Explorer browser works. It's very good to be able to, at a click of a button, find out dog results, to find out how a dog has been viewed, you know, by judges in its lifetime, if there have been health problems. All that kind of data is available. So for breeders, that's phenomenally good.
It is, isn't it? And it does promote responsibility, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And we have consumer legislation to back that up. I think things could be better.
Mm-hmm.
I do think at times that, you know, there is a lot of secrecy between breeders. And I'm not just talking about Basset Hounds. You know, I've got friends that breed Border Collies. I've got friends that breed Collies, Labradors, Irish Wolfhounds. You know, wherever you go, there is some kind of secrecy. And I think that's very typical of the dog world.
Mm.
But
mm.
I think if we are open, work together, make a lot of things, you know, transparent, and work with the general public, good dog breeders will find their way to the top. Good pups, good dogs will find their way to the top. And, you know, the community will all benefit.
Yeah, definitely. That has been really interesting. And thank you ever so much, John.
You're welcome. Thanks. It's nice that you give me a chance to speak. I think one thing I would like to say, though, is that I'm not a representative of the Kennel Club.
No.
I'm just a member of a breeder and a member of a breed club. And I think it's important to say that, you know, these are my personal views. I'm not a spokesperson for either of the Basset Hound Association in Sweden or the Kennel Club.
No. But you have very interesting views.
Thank you.
I thought that was really interesting. You can read more of what John has to say at his blog on bassethounds.nu, and you can contact him on Twitter, where his ID is John Buskell, all one word. We have those links on the Dogcast Radio site, along with a link to the Swedish Kennel Club. If a dog will not come to you after having looked you in the face, you should go home and examine your conscience. Woodrow Wilson.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. X-Men actor Liev Schreiber loves his dog so much he turned down a part in a West End show to avoid spending 6 months away from him. Quarantine regulations would have meant the dog spending all the time Liev would have had in England in kennels, which he found unthinkable. So he chose to stay in New York with his dog rather than take the role in England.
And continuing with the showbiz theme, ex-footballer turned actor Vinnie Jones apparently once got so depressed that he contemplated suicide, and the only thing that stopped him was his dog. His pet dog sat looking at him with such a pleading look that Vinnie decided he had to carry on with his life.
It just shows you how strong our bond with our dogs can be. And British politician, former Home Secretary David Blunkett, was recently injured protecting his dog. Mr. Blunkett relies on Sadie, his guide dog, to get around, and the two were out walking in the Peak District area of the UK. When a cow was alarmed by Sadie, it charged straight for her, and Mr. Blunkett did his best to get between the two animals, sustaining a broken rib in the process.
Fortunately, Sadie was unhurt in the incident, but it was shortly followed a few days later by a tragedy which demonstrated how much worse things could have been. A woman walking her two dogs along the Pennine Way in the UK was trampled to death by a herd of cattle. Apparently the cows had calves and were trying to protect them against the dogs, which were unhurt by the cows and were later found running free near their owner.
A similar death occurred last year, and there are some simple guidelines to follow to avoid problems. The best thing is not to walk your dog near cattle during spring and early summer, which is when they have calves to protect. If you do find yourself in the vicinity of cattle, keep your dog on a lead and stay as far away as possible. In the event of an attack, do your best not to get involved. Let your dog's lead go, as he will almost certainly get himself out of trouble.
Perhaps one dog certain to scare cows would be Pabst, a four-year-old boxer mix who has recently won the title of World's Ugliest Dog. Pabst, who has protruding teeth, is the first non-Chinese crested dog to win the title in several years. But don't worry, a Chinese crested called Ellie, with a tongue constantly lolling out of her mouth, took the title of World's Ugliest Pedigree Dog. The World's Ugliest Dog competition took place in California, and both owners were delighted with their pet's achievements.
And in Britain, a new world record was set in Finsbury Park, London, when the loudest ever collective bark was recorded. 30 dogs managed to register 115 decibels, which broke the previous record of 111 decibels, which was set in Vermont, America.
And finally, in the Kisma Preserve in Mount Desert, Maine, USA, two rescue animals formed an unlikely relationship. One is an adult male Rottweiler, and the other a tiny female rejected wolf cub. They have become inseparable, and if you visit the Dogcast Radio blog, you'll find a link to some wonderful photos of the pair howling together. And that's all from us on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
When a dog wants to hang out the Do Not Disturb sign, as all of us do now and then, he is regarded as a traitor to his species. Ramona C. Albert. Nancy Kay mentioned her veterinary Ten Commandments, and I came across something I thought would mesh with that nicely. I hope you don't find this irreverent, and I hope it makes you smile. On the first day, God created the dog. On the second day, God created man to serve the dog. On the third day, God created all the animals of the earth to serve as potential food for the dog. On the fourth day, God created honest toil so that man could labour for the good of the dog. On the fifth day, God created the tennis ball so that the dog might, or might not, retrieve it. On the sixth day, God created veterinary science to keep the dog healthy and the man broke. On the seventh day, God tried to rest, but he had to walk the dog. Here's a story inspired by the biblical story of Noah, who we all know built an ark to enable him, his family, and two of every animal to survive the great flood. This story happens just as the flood waters had receded, and Noah was encouraging all the animals to leave the ark. All the creatures had left the huge boat, except one of the two dogs. Noah searched everywhere. He looked on the first deck, he looked on the second deck, then the third deck. Finally, in the farthest corner of the lower deck, he found the little dog. The dog was shivering and standing with his nose pressed hard against the side of the boat. "Come here, little dog," called Noah. "It's time to go out. Here, doggy." The little dog wouldn't move, so Noah gently pulled him away. "What's this?" said Noah. "A hole in the ark. The ark might have sunk, little dog. You kept us safe. Me, my family, and all of the animals, with your little nose." The little dog was proud, but mostly he was hungry. "Little dog," said Noah, as he presented him with a juicy bone. "So all the world and all the generations will know your great deed. Your nose will always be cold and wet, just as it is today." That is how the dog got his cold, wet nose. When you feel it, remember the little dog that used his nose to protect Noah, his family, and all of the animals. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
Which dog looks like a cat? A police dog in disguise.